informs us this is the truth. The same God whose story we told parts of yesterday morning does most certainly surround us at all times, near and far, and fills the world. The question that I struggled with for today was, how does this divinity, how does this God come to us? This Lord whose story we told yesterday, how does this Lord come to us? And I know certain ways in which the Lord does not come to us. As other peoples have said that God does come, our Lord does not come, and praise Him for it. He does not come to us like a daimon, as Plato has Socrates say. Plato the Greek said that there was a daimon, that is, a spiritual voice that existed on the inside of Socrates' consciousness, and that this spiritual voice would whisper to him sometimes and tell him what to say or what to do or what was right or what was wrong. This Lord of ours does not arise from the inside only. That word daimon translates poorly. Its cognate in English is demon. Not like that. Nor the opposite of that. Although peoples and Christian peoples have said so, nor does God come and overwhelm us, or the word that's often used is possess us, as though we were a possession, and so swallowed up and drowned. Neither does our God or this divinity come to us only through, although this is part of it but not all of it, through our reason, our rationality, that we should stack one on top of another premises and propositions and come out the other end with a conclusion. We may reason about this God, but our reason is not how the God comes to us to establish relationship. Nor only does the God come to us by powerfully strong emotions, although that's what many, many people feel. They feel that if they do not feel the presence of God, then God is not there. If they do not feel the relationship, if they're not knocked over or fall out or blown up, God is not there. Nor does God come to us, especially God does not come to us by those means of manipulation where human beings of one sort or another keep control. Magic, magical words, magical formulas, sometimes tried to be woven into our liturgies and our worship. Exhaustion. Many peoples have thought that God comes in that emptiness of exhaustion after someone has gone about a religious labor or any labor hard for a long, long time and therefore has become putty, softened. Drugs. Not by drugs. Not by manipulation. This divinity comes to us this way, and it seems to me extraordinary and beautiful. By calling us. We ended yesterday with the story of Jesus standing outside of the tomb, and the one thing that cleared up Mary Magdalene's sight and her ignorance, her inability to define where she was or who she was or who her God was, the one thing that Jesus did was to call her by name. That's how our God comes to us. By calling us, and more than that, by calling each of us individually by our own secret names. And that's a wonder. Because if God calls us by name, then you must understand that it is not a loss of the personality that has that name on it. When God says to me one way or another, Walt, Walt, usually he says it two times over. Samuel, Samuel, like that, see? I am me there, and it is the beginning of the possibility of a relationship, even though that relationship may contain a death, and that death is first of all the Lord's and second of all mine, but that's what's neat. It is from the outside that the Lord comes. It has to be the outside, doesn't it? Because we are so filled up with our own self and with our own sinfulness that that name needs to be called from the outside. The divinity comes to us by a call, and the good thing about a call is that it allows for relationship first. Second of all, it identifies the fact that each one of us possesses an overwhelming, cosmic, almighty power. Each of us. I don't care whether we're very young or whether we're very old. When this divinity calls unto us, we have the ability to say no. And God accepts that. That's why I call it a cosmic and almighty power. It means that we can turn that divinity away. That's how we still possess a will in this relationship. But we also have the ability to have no ability. The alternative to saying no is not, what do you want me to do? I'm rolling up my sleeves, give me the job, I'll do it. Again and again in Scripture, the response that works is only, here I am. That's all. Now that identifies this part of the relationship, me, but it doesn't say that I'm going to now prove myself in this relationship by doing a job. There you are, God, and I'm coming to you by my strength or my goodness or my beauty or my talents. It's just, here I am. In other words, our answer to that call, far from saying no or even from saying, what do you want me to do, is to be nothing. It is simply not to deny it. The beauty of the call is that the strength of responding to the call is not in me, it is in the call. Understand? When Than and I adopted our second child, our first was born to us, the second was adopted, I said to myself, how will I love this child? I really wondered. I wondered if there was a difference between having a child which was of your own flesh and blood and the child which was not. And then when Matthew came to us, I made a wonderful discovery. That my ability to love Matthew as a son was in Matthew. See? It came with the child. It wasn't here before the child came. That's why I asked the question. I didn't love the child when the child was not here. But when the child came, the child brought my ability to love. So the call. When the mighty God says, Moses, Moses, Samuel, Samuel, Walt, Walt, Paul, Paul, Herman, Herman, Bill, Bill, Dean, Jean, Mitch. Hearing the voice is the empowerment of response. And when you are named in the kingdom of God, and when that name truly names you, that's birth. Because don't you understand, when God creates, the final thing that God does in creation, even still today, is to name the creation. It is not nameless, it is named. That was named sky. This was named earth. The light was named day. The darkness was named night. And each of the animals, by the grace of God given unto Adam to do it, or unto us to do it, was named. Now, when you are named, then you are placed. You are given a rightful position within the universe of things. See? And if you have a place in the universe, you have a purpose in the universe. And that purpose threads itself from you, from infinitesimal you, throughout the entire universe. If God names you, and if it is the same God that named all of the universe, then you have your place also in the universe. Do you see how sweet and good it is to be called of God? And then here is the final and most extraordinary goodness. That because it comes as a call, it allows for love. That you may love the one that calls you. You are no puppets. It is a relationship. You find your existence in relationship, and the relationship ultimately is not just purpose and place and future. It is love. You may love the one that called you, and you may know that the one who called you loves you. Saints' Tales. This is Matthew chapter 17, first two verses. Saints' tales, they're all the same, and every one of them is different. Do you know that? They're already in the Old Testament when God wants to do something for God's people, Israel, and God hears the groanings of the people ascending from Egypt, then he calls Moses. And Moses does what every single saint did thereafter. Says, no, I don't think I can. I stutter. How could I go there? Or I don't know your name. Or give me some sign or anything, because I feel so small before this call. Isaiah, who was probably going about priestly duties in the temple, kneeling. This is the sixth chapter of Isaiah, Carl, isn't that right? This was Isaiah's identification. This was his diploma. You understand? All the prophets, in order to show their credentials that they had a right to be God's speakers, identified the diploma or the credential in terms of a call. Huh? And so Isaiah has to write it in the works there somewhere. He says, okay, I'll flash you my credential. It was in the second year of King Uzziah. I was kneeling in the temple like that. And then God was there. The glory of God filled that place. And smoke and the lentils shook while I knelt. Oh, I was so scared, because I am a man of unclean lips and I come from a whole people of unclean lips. See, that same thing happens over and over again, that sense of inability or of smallness when the call comes. Same thing with Peter, who in the boat, after Jesus had brought in all these fishes and Peter began to realize there is a divinity here, said, get away from me, because I'm a sinful person. And St. Peter. This is the 17th chapter of Matthew, first two verses, and it says, after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up to a high mountain apart. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun. In Canada, we said shone. And his garments became as white as light. Now I ask a question. This is a serious question I'm going to ask over and over again this morning of you finally. What if Peter, when Jesus came to him, said no? What if Peter had not accepted this invitation to climb the high mountain apart? What would Peter have missed? Transfiguration. Can you see that fellow, as we said yesterday, in his tank top? I can imagine that this is 6 days, all right? I can imagine that Peter was probably sitting as I am, except with his back to the trunk of an olive tree with the great roots coming out around him like that, and Peter was pouting. Well, he'd had a hard time last week, see? He keeps thinking to himself how he was the only one who said the right thing when Jesus said, who do you say I am? And Peter, popped up and he said, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God, see? And then Jesus pat him on his back and said, good for you, Peter. And Peter said, I know it. And Jesus said to him, no, just wait a minute. Flesh and blood didn't tell you this thing, but God who is in heaven told you this thing. And I tell you, I'm going to give you a new name. I'm going to name you in the universe. No longer are you Simon. You're going to be Peter, see? I'm calling you by this name. And that's the church. And on that rock, I'm going to build my church. And the gates of hell are not going to prevail against it. Peter said, whoo, wow, what a place I have in the universe. So then Jesus didn't stop talking, you see. He kept on talking. This is 6 days ago. And Jesus said, all right, I think you guys are ready to hear the main thing, why I came and what it means to be the Christ. Look, we're going to go to Jerusalem. When we get to Jerusalem, right away Peter says, oh, wait a minute. When we get to Jerusalem, Jesus says, they're going to punish me. The Son of Man is going to suffer at the hands of the people that the Son of Man calls mine, huh? And now Peter's saying, whoa, this isn't what I expected. And then Jesus says, and after suffering, they're going to hand me over to the Roman authorities and they're going to kill me. That's where Peter clicks off his listening, because Jesus goes on to say, and I will rise in 3 days. But now Peter, with his tank top and his big blowhard voice, says, wait a minute, There's all kinds of reasons why that shouldn't happen. God forbid. One reason is I love you and I don't want you to die. And I just finally figured out who you are, the Christ, see? So God forbid you should go to Jerusalem. And then quietly Peter's saying, the other reason is I got to go where you go. See? And if they kill you, what are they going to do to me? So he says, God forbid. And see, he thinks because he's been named Peter, now he's going to do his church work right there. First work of the church he's going to do. Peter the Rock says, God forbid it should happen to you, Lord, or to any of us. And then Jesus rounds on him, and those eyes flash an angry divine fire. And they say, not Peter, oh no, they say, Satan, get you behind me. Get out of my sight, because the things that you are saying are not of God, they are of people. Well, Peter says, I'm not going to talk anymore. I say the wrong thing all the time. And so for 6 days, Peter has been pouting. Stick his bottom lip out. Sitting there, he's got a jackknife, see? And going, throwing that jackknife in the ground. He's saying to all the other apostles, y'all go on. I'm the rock, and I don't even know what that means. I make mistakes all the time. He keeps throwing that. He's playing mumbly peg. They walk by and they try to talk to him, and all he does is boom, show them his back, stick his lip out and pout. Now all of a sudden, while he's sitting there under the sun throwing this knife in the ground, a shadow falls over him. He's not going to look up. He's not going to make any more mistakes. No, not Peter. And it's the Lord. And Jesus says, Peter. And he says, what? And Jesus says, I want you to come with me now. Peter says, like all kids do, where? And Jesus says, Peter, up a mountain. That's where. Peter looks around, sees sitting here in Holden. He says, what mountain? And Jesus says, a high mountain. I'll pick the highest mountain out for you. We'll make it hard for you to walk up, but I'm not mountain, apart from everybody else, you and me. Why? And Jesus says, don't ask questions. What I'm asking for is simply obedience. Come, Peter. Now I ask you the question. What would Peter have missed if he had let his pout, if he had let all of his feelings and his thoughts for his own self and his own reputation and his mistakes, if he had let those things keep him from responding to that call that said, Peter, come with me, what would Peter have missed? The transfiguration. See, I think Jesus knew that at about that point they needed a gift. They needed a break. They needed to know that this being walking with them, stinking in his feet and growing his beard and picking lice, was God. And that it was not just a human being and a friend and a buddy and a teacher and a master that was really walking with them that was going to die in Jerusalem, but 'twas God. And what would Julian? And what would Julian have missed if he had not responded to the voice across the river? I want to tell you a story. It's a saint's tale. This story, I don't know where, but it's in Europe, okay? It's in the stained glass windows of a cathedral. So that this story could surround you if you allowed it to. You could sit within this story, literally. And when the sun shined, it could shine the story on you in refracted and beautiful colors. It would surround you in stone and in glass, and you could be lost in the midst of it. It is how they used to tell stories in the Middle Ages. This is a saint's tale about Saint Julian Hospitator. But the question remains the same. Julian was born to a wealthy couple, a man who owned a great deal of land in Europe, and his wife, and Julian was their only son. Julian's young life was almost unremarkable, except for one or two facts, which were remembered forever and forever, even down to today, about Julian. He remembers that when he used to go to church, when they used to go to Matins or Vespers, or Mass on Sunday morning, what used to irritate him was a mouse, a little white mouse that was not worshiping with anybody else. Because while everybody else had to sit quiet and watch the priest go through the drama that priests go through for the people, this mouse would come out of the corner of the wall and go skittering across the stone floor. And Julian's whole attention was brought from the priest to that little mouse. And he used to watch it and think about it. One day when services were over and everybody had left, Julian waited for that mouse. Now it's a strange thing, but he had some hatred in his heart for this mouse. I can't say why. He hated the mouse that did not worship with everybody else. He took a little hammer with him, and he waited at the hole, and he just sat there. And it is amazing what control this little boy had while he sat there, that he didn't move and he didn't breathe. In time, the mouse came out of that hole, and Julian took the hammer and hit it. And then he caught his breath, because he killed it. One drop of blood came out of its white mouth and sat there, and the mouse was dead. And this amazed him, that it took so little to kill a creature. Not only did it amaze him, but this is the fact that of Julian's childhood. It made him hungry. It gave him a small, quiet, invisible, but effective thrill on the inside that he could reach out a hammer and kill a being and make it bleed at its mouth, one red drop of blood. After that, a new thing seized Julian, and he did as boys of his era did. He was trained in the arts of war, but Julian was good. He was good not only because he had been given the skill to use the sword or the lance or the crossbow, but because he had bloodlust in his soul. Julian wanted to kill. And when that bloodlust took over him, he did, and almost nothing could stop him. Julian had a skill in killing, but it was because he had such a desire to kill. As he grew into his teen years, it would be possible for Julian to leave home in the morning with nothing but a sword, a spear, and a crossbow, and commit slaughter throughout the forests of his father. Every little creature that he saw to run across his path, he could, with a quick flick, kill it. And it made him the hungrier and the hungrier for the blood that ran when he killed it, so that he would leave a slaughter behind him. And the animals of the forest grieved for Julian. The story is told of one day when he went out at the early dawn, when there were still the mists on the land, and the animals were all around him. There were birds in the sky. There were the four-footed creatures, there were the small ones, and Julian almost sated himself with a constant slaughtering of every single one of these animals. His eyes were more wild than any beast or bear that you might see running down out of the mountains. He killed and he killed and he left bodies behind him wherever he went. His nostrils flared. He breathed deep with the killing until at evening he came to a valley, to the very edge of the valley, and deep in that valley he saw deer. So many deer scattered out throughout that entire valley. He reared back and picked up his crossbow and twanged one bolt after another, and it was amazing the accuracy with which every bolt went. It found the ribs of one deer after another, and they sank on their legs, and they died, and he created an almighty confusion among them, so that even as he was killing some, others reared and trampled the others, and they all died, so that they didn't get out of the valley at all. There was a slaughter to remember. But when he was done, and trying hard to catch his breath, he saw on the far side of the valley three deer undead. One beautiful stag, four-pointed, holding its head high and staring right back at Julian out of a wise eye. A doe with a coat that was mixed with the most gentle colors. And behind the doe, as though she were trying to protect it, a fawn. Julian set his teeth, and even while the stag watched, he released a bow. He released a bolt that found its place into the armpit of that doe, and she sighed, and she dropped, and she died. And immediately next, he let another one go, and it hit the fawn, and the fawn, without a word, died. And now Julian trembled because of the last living creature that was in that valley, the last living thing that he had seen all day, and he released then one final bolt, which went directly to the stag and hit it in the forehead and sank into its brain, but the stag did not fall. The stag began to walk through the valley toward Julian, who was transfixed by this, stepping over the dead and coming closer and closer to Julian with his bolt sticking out of its forehead. And the stag said, accursed, looking at Julian directly in the eye, who was trembling and could not pull another bolt. Accursed, said the stag, you will, Julian. You will, before you are done, kill your father and your mother. And then the stag lay down dead. Well, that terrified the boy. Julian went home and tried very hard to keep a watch on himself that this bloodlust shouldn't slip out and somehow or other touch his parents. It scared him night and day. One day he was walking along a promenade, and there was a stone wall to his right, and he thought that he saw fluttering on the other side of the stone wall a bird. He thought it was a white dove, and he whirled around and he shot a bolt at it, and it took it away, and he went to see on the other side of the wall whether he had killed that bird or not, and it was no bird at all. It was his mother's coif, and she was standing there with her hands over her mouth because he had not hit her, but he had taken her coif off, and that scared him. How easy it was to kill his mother. Another day, on this enormous wall on the inside of the hall, way at the top, were crossed swords, and Julian went up to get one of those swords, and while he was up there, he dropped it, and it clanged to the ground, and when he looked down, he saw that his father was there, and it had just missed his father, and that was enough for Julian. He remembered that curse of the stag. He left home. He went into a far country. And there he grew up, finally. He gave himself into the army of a king. And there Julian could practice his bloodlust to the very end, because this king was at war. And now it was not animals that Julian was killing. It was people, soldiers. He was an exemplary soldier. He worked his way up through the ranks until he was the general of all of the king's army. And when Julian was the general, you must understand, the wars came to an end, and that king was victorious. And so it seemed that Julian at midlife had come to a point where he could relax from his wars. The king in gratitude gave him, the king gave his daughter to Julian as a wife, and they retired. This should be the end of the story. They lived in a house, a good house. They lived year after year there, but it isn't. One day, Julian, still unable finally to have completed this bloodlust in himself, left home just for a day. He said to his wife, I'll be back at evening. And as he walked through the woods, he began to tremble. Because once again, almost exactly as it was 15 years before, he saw the animals everywhere. And he began to feel this desire rise up in him to kill the animals, as he had before. only this time it was different. Every time he tried to kill a creature, he missed. Something blunted his sword. Something made his arrows fly away so that the creatures lived around him and he couldn't touch them. Neither did they know him, nor did he know them. Julian was alone. But time after time, he tried to kill, and he couldn't, and that frustrated him. It built up that bloodlust in him almost to a climactic level. It made the blood pour behind his eyeballs so that when he looked out at the world, it was through a sheen of red, but it was his own red blood that he was looking at it through, and it was a terrible day for him. At evening, his wife heard a knock on the door. She opened it. It was not Julian. It was two elderly people. It was a woman with iron gray hair hanging down to her waist. It was beautiful hair, iron gray, that she should keep it so long. And a very handsome man with a wild beard on his face. And they looked old and they looked poor. And they said, "Does Julian live here?" And the wife said, "Yes." And they said, "Thank God, we have been looking for him. He is our son." Now, Julian had said nothing to his wife about the parents, and she was overjoyed to see Julian's parents, his heritage, walk into the house like that. And so she fed them and sat them at the table, and they waited for Julian, but Julian didn't come. When they grew tired after their travels, she invited them to sleep, that Julian would surely see them in the morning, and she put them in her bed. Julian came home after dark, late, frustrated. He walked into the house, and he saw that there had been some people eating at the table. He thought to himself that he would surprise his wife with his love. And he went to her room. In the dark, he put out his hand to the form that was in the bed. And he found a beard. And he put his hand to the other form that was in the bed, and he touched the long and beautiful hair. And then all of the anger and the rage that had built up in him that day when he could not kill the animals hit the top of his skull and made him pull out his sword and in two skillful jabs to kill both the man that was lying there and to kill the woman whom he supposed to be his wife. And when he had done that, he heard behind him in the doorway a gasp. And he looked and it was his wife. And she held a lantern which she dropped on the ground and he picked it up and he looked. And it was his parents. He had killed him, as the stag had said. He told his wife that she would never see him again. And he left. Julian went out into the world, despising himself. That the thing which he had feared, the gravest sin of all, he had committed. And he wandered and he wandered far from any cities or civilization whatsoever because he could not bear for other human beings to look upon him, Julian, who had done this thing. Any time a human being happened to glance at him, it was as if their eyes raked him with fire because he was no longer a human. He was no longer one who possessed the right to be a part of society. He despised himself. He thought he would kill himself. He thought he would drown himself. He had no right to live. He went to a pool of water that was still on the surface of it and knelt and looked into that water before he should sink into it and drown. And when he looked into the water, he saw his father's face in the mirror image. You understand, it was his own face, but it was his own face that had grown into his father's face now, and he could not bring himself to kill his father twice. And so even death was denied him. Society and any self-respect and death were all denied Julian. Finally, he came to a river and he said, "This is what I will do." He found a boat by the river, half sunk in the mud, and he pulled it out and he repaired it and he made it watertight. And he said, "This is what I will do. I will take people across this river." There was neither ford nor bridge at this river. So Julian said, "This is all that I may do. This is all that I am worthy to do. I will row them across the river."
He built himself a little hovel out of the bark and the scraps that he could find, something so small that you could only bow down to be inside of it. And he made himself a bed out of ticking with leaves and bark and needles, and that's what he slept on. And the word got around. There was this old man, the word got around, who was on the edge of the river. And if you wanted now to take this road, which is quicker to such and such a city, you could call Julian, and Julian would come and take you across the river. And so he did for many years, never loving who he was, never feeling cleansed of the sin of the bloodlust, but doing it. It was a life. One night a storm blew, a storm so wild that Julian stayed on the inside of the hovel and still felt the water come through the cracks. The wind howled on the outside and the rain lashed down, and he could hear the river leaping up in mountainous waves all around him. But through the sound of the wind and the lashing rain and the waves, he heard a voice. He heard a voice calling, barely to be heard, calling, "Julian! Julian!" And he went out of his hovel and he stood on his side of the river and he looked on the other side and he could barely make out a figure standing there and calling to him. Now he had a decision to make. And in fact, from now on, it was constantly decisions that Julian had to make. Should he try to cross the wild water and get to the other side in this kind of a night to bring this figure across? And the voice said, "Julian!" And so he did. He pulled his boat, his painter, and pushed it into the water, and he set a lantern on the end, which rocked back and forth wild, and it made strange shadows all around him. And he pulled across the river to the other side, and when he came there, he saw a singular figure standing straight up and covered with leprosy. The eyes in that lantern seemed to burn, and around the eyes was such a redness that it was sickening to look at. And always the decision, but he held the boat still while the leper stood in and did not sit down. The leper simply stood in the back of the boat. And it was a shock to Julian how that boat tilted into the water. It would almost sink, it would seem, and he couldn't understand why that single figure should be so heavy. But he tried to row back into the water. Now, the heaviness of that figure made rowing terribly difficult, and you must understand, you who hear this story, that every single pull on the oar was Julian's last. Because every single pull was a decision whether or not he should pull again. Because the water was roaring and it was pulling them downstream and the wind was against them and there was that weight in the back of that. And so it was every single time saying, but should I do it again? And Julian did. When they got to the other side, the figure stepped out of the boat and did not walk away. It simply stood there looking at Julian, and that made Julian terribly uncomfortable. This is not what people did when they had received what Julian had to give them, which was simply a little transportation. The figure said, "Julian, I'm wet." And Julian looked at this little hovel that he had left, barely could hold him, but so nevertheless he invited the leper into the hovel. And then he could see, and you must see, that this leper was covered with pustules that ran and stank foul out of its breath and from the skin and from this pus, and was so skinny. Sat down in Julian's hovel and said, "Julian, I'm hungry." Well, Julian had only one flitch of bacon, but took that bacon and gave it to the leper, and then that leper ate with such ravenous hunger, it made Julian smack his lips and be hungry too, except the leper ate all the bacon. And so then Julian was left hungry himself. And the leper said, "Julian, I'm thirsty." Well, Julian took all he had, which is water, but as he brought it to the leper, it smelled so sweet, almost like wine. And it made Julian thirsty too. He thought then he would drink when the leper was done. Except the leper, skinny as he was, drank all the water gone. And there was none left, and so Julian was left hungry and thirsty. And the leper said, "Julian, I'm cold." And looked at Julian's little bed. So Julian invited the leper into the bed and took his own blanket and over that. Oh, and posture.
body, laid the blanket, and the leper lay for a while, trembling and shivering, skinny, and the leper said, Julian, I'm still cold. Indicated that Julian should lie down next to him. So Julian took his body and slipped under covers next to the leper, could feel the scrapings, you understand, of the scab, and be enveloped by the breath of this thinking leper, and lay down next to him, and felt like ice on him, shivering. And the leper said, Julian, I'm still cold. And so now Julian got up and lay full length on the leper, arm for arm, and leg for leg, and face for face, and put his lips on the leper's lips. And then the hair of that leper stood straight out from his head as though it were electricity, and began to shine like a nimbus, like a radiance. And at that point, Julian wanted to pull away, except that the leper's hands went around Julian, the arms went around Julian, and they began to swell and to pop with their muscles. The being of the leper itself swelled and became mightier and greater, and so the chest of the leper was broader than Julian's itself, and the leper stood up, holding Julian off the ground, and grew larger and larger until the roof of that hovel burst off, and the leper rose up from the ground, holding Julian and higher, and it was Jesus Christ, our Lord. And so I ask you the question. What would Julian have missed if he had said no to the call across the river? What glorious perception of the presence of God in the foulest and most stinking being? What deep understanding of the wholeness of the love of God, whole, healthy, and holy, would Julian have missed if he had not answered that call? No, people. Let me put it another way. What will you miss if you do not answer the call? When you go home from Holden, for some of you, there may be a human being, a man, let's say, who on the outside world is smarmy, really contemptible. Worse than that, at home, may even use his body to abuse his wife and his children. And you hear that, and you see the difference between this smarminess in the world where he works and this arrogance at home where he hurts people. What will you do when that one calls your name? Or the children. I don't mean the sweet and good children who are so lovely to touch. I mean the foul children. I mean the ones who know how to spit at adults, around whom you do not wish to be, who are that way because of the despair into which they are born and the hunger that they always live with. They are in America. They are in our cities. What will you do when that child calls you by name? Or even those whose voices you cannot hear because they come out of Central America, yes, and out of Africa and the Third World, but who call you specifically by name from the other side of the wild waters in the river. What will you do when you are called out of the comfort of your home and your lifestyle and your professions? What decision will you make? Oh, what a transfiguration you may miss not to know that the voice of God may come to you out of lepers.